From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Hayes Valley.
Rock Ridge in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, San Bruno will get $70 million from PG&E and a new program to recycle unused drugs.
People, consumers, could return unused medications over the counter, just like we do with batteries and tires and other things.
Also, with rising sea levels, the Bay Area's waterfront landscape might look very different soon if we don't plan for it.
A lot of the work that was done to kind of bring nature under control in the 20th century has to be redone in the 21st century.
And we'll celebrate a highly irrational number.
Learning about pi is something that's a never-ending task. And so we thought we should make a shrine to this never-ending taskness.
Stay tuned for Cross Currents. Today, the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, or PG&E, announced it will pay the city of San Bruno $70 million in restitution from the pipeline explosion of September 9, 2010, which killed 8 people and destroyed dozens of homes. Jim Ruane is the mayor of San Bruno, which has a population of about 40,000 people. I asked him what the settlement does.
Well, the settlement puts $70 million in a bank account, and then after this money is confirmed in the account and PG&E is guaranteed it will be there within 30 days, we will set up a not-for-profit entity to manage those funds. And along with that, we'll get public input from all of our citizens, our whole community, our city, to find out what people would like to see done with this money. And so there's nothing been targeted yet. We haven't even done a lot of speculation as to what people would like to see, but it's something going forward that hopefully will help to soothe our community. We are still traumatically affected and will be, frankly, forever. We'll never really be the same. And this is totally separate from a $50 million fund that PG&E has set up, a trust, to actually rebuild the infrastructure, if you will, the sewer lines, the water lines, the streetscape, the park, the canyon, all the different things that have to be rebuilt because of this blast. So this will be totally separate. It will not be used to pay for city salaries, will not be used to balance any budget, nothing. It won't be used to take care of our general fund, if you will. It's going to be totally separate. And our understanding from PG&E, and we have asked them, and they have confirmed with us that this money is from shareholders, not ratepayers, and they will not go to CPUC to try to recoup this amount in increased rates.
And so you said that there's going to be a community process to determine what you're going to do with this, the money, with the settlement funds. What will that process look like, and how long do you expect it to take?
Well, a little bit too premature to say that. I want to get the money in the bank first and then see how we're going to set up this not-for-profit entity. And then we'll be talking to the staff at the city to see how we're going to set it up. What we've done in a lot of other cases that really had nothing to do with this is we set up maybe citizens advisory committees, or we have total public input, especially concerning this terrible tragedy we had. We've involved the community in every step of the way with public meetings, informational meetings, social meetings, to find out what they'd like to see in their neighborhood going forward, the flexibility we might have for streetscapes and planting and those types of things, for instance. So there's a lot of questions still left unanswered. PG&E purchased a number of lots there from people that were not coming back. We still have to talk to them about the disposition and how we're going to handle those. So we still have a long way to go, but in principle, PG&E agreed a number of months ago. In August, we started discussions with them, with Chris Johns and myself.
And let me just mention that Chris Johns is the president of PG&E.
Yes, he is president of PG&E.
Go on, you told him.
We went to them and said, we as a city have been harmed too. We are victims in this, the city as a whole. It's not, and I don't say just the neighborhood lightly, but it's not the neighborhood. There's a lot of other permanent lawsuits going on with the victims and their attorneys with PG&E, a totally separate issue that we are really not privy to. Those, I hope, PG&E will settle sooner than later. They're scheduled for a trial coming up here in, I believe it's June, and they're trying to get, I think the county wants a special master, if you will, to try to look at them all together. But there are literally hundreds of plaintiffs out there, and the city is really not involved in that particular endeavor.
Were these negotiations tough?
In principle, the PG&E agreed that they had damaged the city. They said, yes, we do agree that you are, in fact, a victim. And then when we sat down at the table, we walked through a lot of, as lawyers do, a lot of, crossing the T's and dotting the I's. And then things kind of hit a standstill about a month ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we decided instead of being, you know, the city going through all of this, and if you will, nice guys with the gloves on, we decided to hold a press conference and bring PG&E to task to say, wait a minute, you know, this has to go quicker. We need you to sit down with us realistically, and let's get this thing settled. I spoke to Chris Johns. He suggested that the principals speak, if you will, and we didn't talk about so much dollars and cents other than I told him, Chris, we kind of know what you want, and you know what we want. Let's get this done. Make this happen. And he did, and we did, and I'm glad to say that within 30 days that money will be in the bank, and then we'll move forward to the next chapter of this story.
What is that next chapter?
The next chapter will be every day is a new one, I can tell you. The next chapter is finding out what the public would like to see done with this money, as well as part of the next chapter is actually digging in the streets to replace all of the things with the trust fund that have to be done. We have a long way to go. I mean, there's 13 residents right now ready to actually move back into their new homes, which is just great. Probably another 12 to 13 that are in the planning process, and maybe another 12 or so that will not come back as far as people that do not want to rebuild, and then obviously some people can't come back. So that every day is a new chapter for us. It's uncharted territory for a lot of this type, and we've looked into this with our negotiating team. This type of settlement we don't believe has ever been enacted before, where a utility actually pays a city and says, you know, I'm sorry that this happened. We hope this restitution will help you going forward.
It was about a year ago that the National Transportation Safety Board issued a report that blamed PG&E for baffling mistakes and lax oversight. What reforms have happened as a result of the San Bruno blast?
Well, we were in Washington to actually accept the report in August of last year, and they not only blamed PG&E directly, they blamed the CPUC. There are a lot of recommendations that they had.
CPUC is the
forward.
California Public Utility Commission.
Correct.
Yeah, go
correct.
On.
So they put out a lot of recommendations, and hopefully PG&E, and I, Chris Johns told me after this happened, he said, okay, we'll take responsibility, and it's my intention, he said, to implement every single one of these recommendations. So I know they've been hydrostatically testing the lines all over the Bay Area, line 132, the one that blew in our community. They've tested it up and down the peninsula, and it blew twice since then with hydrostatic testing, water testing, once in Woodside and once, I believe, in Palo Alto. So they have a lot of work to do. They've had some record-keeping issues that the CPUC, I believe, is going to talk about. They're coming down here with their first hearing and first penalty phase of the record-keeping issues, I think today. Today, if it's not going to be put off, it was supposed to be a week ago. So they have fines and penalties going forward, and they will probably be fairly substantial. So, PG&E has a lot of work to do. Let's just get on with it.
And you were about a year into your tenure as mayor when the PG&E blast happened in 2010. How has it been trying to get on with it and try and help this community heal?
Well, the strength for all of us has been this community. We've always been tight. We're a special little city, we feel, as probably a lot of cities do. But when this happened, the outpouring of help within our community and from without our community was just unbelievable. Some things you have to try to, you sit there and you try to rationalize, well, this and that. And sometimes you just have to sit back and accept things, accept the heart of this community, how wonderful it is, the people, how they get together. It's just been, in some ways, a very, very, as you can imagine, very, very difficult experience, but in other ways, a very heartening and wonderful experience to see this community come together.
Jim Ruane is the mayor of San Bruno. PG&E announced today that it will pay the city $70 million in restitution. In other local news, this morning, San Francisco Sheriff Rosmir Karimi pleaded guilty to one misdemeanor charge of false imprisonment. Under the deal, he'll serve no jail time. Mir Karimi was arrested on January 13th and charged with three misdemeanors of domestic violence, dissuading a witness, and child endangerment. He'll be sentenced next Monday, and the deal is reported to include 3 years of probation, community service, and a year of domestic violence prevention classes. Oh, You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Prescription drug use is rising. By 2007-2008, half of all Americans were taking one or more prescription drugs, and 37% of older Americans took five or more. That's according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Clearly, some of these medicines help us live longer and healthier lives. However, not all prescription drugs or over-the-counter medications are swallowed. They expire or the patient simply doesn't want them anymore. In Alameda County, some supervisors say these unwanted drugs are a problem for environmental and public health. They're proposing a new law that would force drug makers to set up collection and disposal programs. KALW's Judy Silber reports.
Any unused medicines at home? No. All right.
Like any other pharmacy, United Pharmacy in Berkeley fills prescriptions. But this small drugstore is a little unusual. In addition to handing out drugs, it also takes them back.
The bin, as you can see, it's itemized on the front.
Near the front of the store, pharmacist Pam Gums points to a green metal bin shaped like a mailbox.
It has step-by-step instructions. You open the bin, you put your pills in the front, and then you close the bin.
Gum says the pharmacy serves between 10 and 20 customers a day, and four or five of those drop off unwanted or expired medications. The bin is part of a limited drug take-back program in Alameda County. In the whole county, about 24 spots accept medications.
It just seems to me to be unfair that people aren't able to dispose of these medications in a convenient way.
Supervisor Nate Miley is sponsoring an ordinance that would put the burden on pharmaceutical companies, requiring them to organize and pay for drug disposal. The proposed law must go through two rounds of votes. Supervisors approved it for the first time on February 28th, and tomorrow, it goes before them for a final vote. If approved, Miley says it will become the first of its kind in the country.
Basically, what I'd like to see happen is that a program be established by the pharmaceutical industry so that people, consumers, could return unused medications over the counter to their local pharmacy. And just like we do with batteries and tires and other things.
This kind of product stewardship is a growing trend in the waste industry. California has passed stewardship laws for carpet, paint, and mercury thermometers. With pharmaceuticals, advocates argue it could solve several problems. Unused drugs flushed down the toilet or leaching from landfills ultimately end up in a water system not designed to treat them. Or they can sit in medicine cabinets where they become potential sources of danger for young children and teenagers.
There's a lot of data that shows that there's you know, it's like 25% of all drug-related crime relates to pharmaceuticals. There's teen farming. There's suicide.
Joel Kreisberg helped author the Alameda Bill. He's executive director of the Teleosis Institute, a nonprofit that promotes environmental health.
50% of all poisonings in emergency room visits come from pharmaceutical ingestion. And so those are social issues. And this really can make a big impact if you don't have pills lying around people's houses.
Industry trade group Pharma denied repeated requests for comment. But in a letter to supervisors, the group warned that such a law could add to rising health care costs. Pharma also disputed environmental concerns, saying it's sufficient to dispose of medications at landfills rather than flushing them down the toilet. But Stephen Gressett, founding director of the International Institute for Pharmaceutical Safety, disagrees.
There have been some incidents of landfill operators going through plastic bags looking for drug pills. There are people in the environmental world who argue that landfill is not the best because it does end up in the leachate, which then goes to plants which can't remove it, the water treatment plants.
Several states, including California, Washington, and Maine, have tried passing stewardship laws for pharmaceuticals, but without success. A federal bill has also stalled in Congress. Gressett says the Alameda County decision could have a ripple effect.
Those who are involved in drug disposal or efforts to reduce drug waste, I think, are watching it very carefully.
Even if the county passes the law, Gressett questions whether Alameda can handle monitoring drug companies all over the world for compliance. And he says it may not make sense to pass separate laws for every county.
The point being then that there would be conflicting or incongruent or mismatched plans from county to county across the country.
About a year ago, San Francisco got to the very place Alameda is now. Supervisors gave an initial yes, and then pharma stepped in. The trade group brokered a deal. No law, and they would donate $100,000 for a pilot program. Plus, biotech giant Genentech pitched in another $10,000. That program is just getting started, and San Francisco officials guess the money will last from 3 months to a year. Then they'll need to come up with another plan. It's not clear yet what will happen in Alameda County. After months of ignoring the ordinance, pharma and local trade group Bay Bio began pressuring county supervisors last week. The ordinance is scheduled for a vote tomorrow. In Oakland, I'm Judy Silber for Cross Currents.
What do you do with your old or unused medications? Do you have alternative ways of safely disposing of them? You can share your thoughts by calling 415-264-7106. That number again to leave us a message is 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your call on the air. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Those are the sounds of ferries crisscrossing the bay. They land at terminals including Oakland's Jack London Square and San Francisco's Ferry Building. Both are tourist destinations, and both are built on landfill. In fact, practically all of Oakland and San Francisco's bayfront shoreline is constructed, built up to accommodate metropolitan growth. It seems permanent, concrete and steel, roads and buildings, but it's not. Scientists say sea level rise will change the way our waterfronts look within the next century, and maybe even sooner. And that's why developers consult with people like Robin Grossinger. Grossinger is a scientist at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, where he directs the Historical Ecology Program. Essentially, he's a historical sleuth, unearthing and deciphering old maps, stories, and landscapes to figure out what California looked like before European contact. And Bay Area planners use his work to build smarter, more sustainable developments. Robin Grossinger was recently honored by the Bay Nature Institute as its Environmental Educator of the Year. He dropped by our studio to talk with KALW's Ben Trefney about building in harmony with nature.
Well, it's almost every place we've looked. I mean, that's one of the interesting things is that you realize most of us here if we grew up in California, I have grown up here since I was 9, but I don't have grandparents and, you know, great-grandparents who told me about the history of the landscape. We're all kind of making it up as we go along, and people often wonder what it used to look like. So there is the risk in these restoration efforts that we might kind of mythologize or import ideas, you know, from the East Coast or the Midwest of what a river should look like.
You make a great river there, like right through the middle of Marin County, and there never was one there in the first place.
Yeah, and maybe that's okay if it's going to work, but it probably won't work out that well because many things are still the same. It's still, you know, still a Mediterranean semi-arid climate. Topography is still the same. The soils are still the same. So there's plenty of ways to get it wrong, but pretty much everywhere we go in, it is a slight surprise, like what we find. For example, scientists in the Bay Area didn't really realize how many beaches there were in the Bay. You need to think about beaches on the outer coast of California, but we had almost 30 miles of beaches in the Bay, and those were even popular for, you know, all the reasons beaches are popular up into the 20th century, but then they were all filled and pretty much gone and forgotten.
Filled as landfill to
build
properties.
Yeah, freeways built out, you know, landfill for airports and, you know, downtowns and all the, you know, important things of progress. But interesting thing is then when you look more closely, we found that a lot of beaches have come back. In the meantime, they kind of rebuilt themselves. The processes are still there. you know, of tides and water and
depositing sediment.
Depositing sediment. And so you have a number of new beaches, you know, 7, 8, 10 miles of beach that's come back in similar patterns and size and orientation, but different spots, right? Because it's adjusting and accommodating to the built environment. And then...
Where's that happening?
Throughout the Central Bay, parts of Berkeley and Albany and San Francisco and Marin. And an interesting thing is that scientists looking at that, looking at sort of the historical characteristics and then how what the beaches today look like, have started designing new beaches that might be strategically brought back or sort of recreated to provide habitat for some species and then also sea level rise buffers, you know, provide, a kind of natural buffer against, some of the challenges that we'll face. It'd be nice to have beaches actually bordering our communities, providing a little bit of protection.
And that's something that the natural environment might have had there in the first place that ended up protecting the land inside, but wetlands and beaches have dissipated over time.
Right. So we realize we can actually draw upon these historical examples to design the landscapes of the future and actually get back some of the functions that we might actually like to have.
That's Robin Grossinger. He's senior scientist at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, where he's also director of the Historical Ecology Program. So you have a book that's coming out. It's Napa Valley Historical Ecology Atlas, Exploring a Hidden Landscape of Transformation and Resilience. What's something in the Napa Valley that is completely the same as it was 200 years ago based on your research? And what's something that's utterly different?
One remarkable example of persistence is an oak grove that we were lucky enough to get to visit on a private property in the Oak Knoll area, the Lamoureux family. So it's a rare place in the valley. The valley was covered with great oak trees, great valley oaks, an oak savanna, and it was really, everyone was just blown away by the beauty of this quote-unquote park-like landscape, the grand trees. And There really are no other examples in the valley of a bigger grove, though. There's individual trees remaining. And so this place is really quite a beautiful spot, and you get kind of this feeling of being in a cathedral of oaks, these incredibly big trees and a whole world of bird life up above. And then, bizarrely enough, we went to the archives about years after taking a photograph of that spot and found a photograph of that same spot that had been taken in 1907, almost exactly 100 years, almost to the day before our photograph. And it looks almost the same. You can see the same leaning tree. You can see the same mix of trees, although a few fewer trees, but you can see the same feature persisting through time. So those points are real reminders that we do live in a landscape and that these processes are pretty strong. They don't just suddenly go away. So what about on the opposite side? I think one of the striking things on Napa River, as well as pretty much most every other river we've studied in California, is how even when it looks pretty natural, like, you know, a sinuous river with trees alongside it, a curvy river, how different that is from how it used to be. In Napa, there are places that, the river looks somewhat natural, but it turns out it's incised, it's cut down 20, 25 feet and used to flow through wetlands and willow groves in a particular spot. So maybe used to have a broad zone of wetlands and channels and complexity that was maybe thousands of feet wide, and now it's just a narrow little strip.
Yeah, as you talk about that, I imagine rivers that I've seen, whether they're large or small, but they're all pretty contained. The wetlands surrounding rivers doesn't exist in too many places that I see. Almost they're always creeks or channels or rivers, but they end up resembling some sort of a canal.
That's exactly right. I think... one of the things that's hard to see in our contemporary landscape is how homogenized these systems have been, even when they look slightly natural, they've been so simplified and sort of restricted in terms of how they express themselves. And so a lot of the effort in our work and in this book is to show the complexity and the diversity of the landscape, how different habitats express themselves and the complexity. And that's important because that complexity is what provided the biodiversity and the resilience, really, to variations in climate, floods and droughts, the real ability to respond to different climatic events, and you know, it is a lot of what we've lost in landscape today.
Of course, those rare climatic events aside, I mean, they do happen, obviously, the regular floods and that kind of thing. It's a lot easier to build a community around a controlled river than to build it all on stilts on a wetlands.
That's right. We're not going to go all the way back. But the interesting thing is that, you know, many flood control agencies, or at least some nowadays, are finding that their communities want something in between. They don't necessarily want an engineered concrete flood control channel. They still would like some flood protection, but they're often willing to give a little bit of land and have something that is more aesthetically appealing and actually safer and more ecologically functional. So Napa River is a great example where they've done a living river approach to flood protection, and they've used wetlands and widening the river corridor to gain a lot of flood capacity for the city of Napa. So it's, you know, the idea of natural flood protection, which is also being applied in Santa Clara Valley, is, you know, has a lot of potential to, you know, bring back elements of these systems still while providing flood protection. And the, you know, and the interesting thing is that, of course, you know, a lot of the engineering that happened in the 20th century is not going to last forever. It has maybe 50-year lifespan, 75-year lifespan. So a lot of the work that was done to kind of bring nature under control in the 20th century has to be redone in the 21st century. We sort of have a second shot at many of these things. You can see the Bay Bridge is being rebuilt. Salt ponds are turning over. A lot of the landscape is flexible and dynamic. It continues to change.
Robin Grossinger directs the Historical Ecology Program at the San Francisco Estuary Institute. He was recently honored by the Bay Nature Institute as its Environmental Educator of the Year. You can find that interview, along with another conversation with environmental hero Ellie Cohen, at our website. It's klw.org. And that's also where you can subscribe to our podcast. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Every year here at KALW, we have a little competition.
Come on!
A friendly competition. It's our annual pie-off. Not pie eating, pie baking. This past year, we had 10 entries, and after a raucous contest, our editor, Ben Trefney, won.
Come on! Come on!
The year before, there were 16 contestants. Our engineer, Chris Hoff, took top honor.
Boom! That's what I'm talking about!
Well, this Wednesday, people around the world will be talking about a different kind of pie. 3.14159265358979323. The number pi is all around us. It's fundamental to our understanding of the universe. It's how we measure circles. And for an abstract mathematical concept, it has a lot of cultural currency. March 14th, that's 314, is International Pi Day, and it got its start at the Exploratorium right here in San Francisco. So what do you need to know about pi? KALW's Casey Miner has this brain vitamin.
Improved learning ability and academic performance, short-term and long-term memory, can be systematically developed in any student of any age.
Deep inside our brain is something rather like the brain of a crocodile.
The basic definition of the number pi is that it doesn't have an exact value. It's an infinite calculation. But it is possible to know the exact number of people required to sing a fully orchestrated song about it.
Pi day, pi day, happy you. Pi day,
16 people.
We are Buffon's Needle.
I'm at San Francisco's Exploratorium a few days before this year's Pi Day celebration with the 16-person band in question. The name Buffon's Needle is a reference to an 18th-century French mathematician who approximated the value of pi by throwing pine needles on the ground.
He took needles and he took some lines on a floor, and the needles were about half the width of each line. And he threw the needles on the floor, and then he counted to see how many crossed the lines, and then he divided them by the number of lines.
Kamara Pettis is the band's lead singer.
He came to the conclusion that, is it 7 over 22? 22 over 7 approximates pi the closest.
And for this reason, some people also celebrate pi on July 22nd. But I digress. To the members of Buffon's Needle, pi is a number worthy of celebration.
It has kind of a sense of wonder and a sense of magic to it, that it's not like 8 or 272. It's a number that just kind of doesn't end. It kind of continues and continues and continues, and there's something very kind of magical about that to me.
The most pi places that somebody's memorized is 100,000, pi to 100,000 places. Mnemonics are pretty fascinating.
That's Chaz Thompson and Adam Green. They're also in the band. And just so you know, the verified memorization record is actually 67,890 digits, set in 2006. The number of digits that have been officially calculated, though, is 2 quadrillion. It took 1,000 computers almost a month to do that one. And here you thought computers were just for email. Scientists like Larry Shaw love that stuff.
Here, but just maybe tell me like what you had for breakfast this morning.
3 cookies. Round cookies. They have to be round.
Round cookies.
Of course.
Shaw's a physicist who's worked at the Exploratorium for 33 years, and one of the highlights was launching the Pi Day celebration in 1988.
Learning about pi, or what the digits are, is something that's a never-ending task. And so we thought we should make a shrine to this never-ending taskness.
The Exploratorium does have a literal shrine. It's a small plaque embedded in the floor that's the focus of much pomp every year. Shaw says that part's always fun, but there are also other ways people relate to pi.
You can sing pi, and you can count pi. Somebody sent me a sheet of 10,000 digits of pi with all the 42s circled. Other people have used pi as a constraint for writing poetry.
Like this poem, where the number of letters in each word corresponds to a digit in pi.
That there, obstinate in you, O strange constant, a divine sign, O exists, is unlikely unless, is O revealed something brilliant, negating belief.
It's just abstract.
And for centuries, it's been inspirational. So on Wednesday, if you think of it, take a moment for pi. But remember, this year's celebration is only accurate to 2 digits. So if you really want to celebrate, you should wait 3 years. For Saturday, March 14th, 2015, at 9:26 p.m. and 35 seconds. At the Exploratorium, I'm Casey Miner for Cross Currents.
Have you ever celebrated Pi Day? How do you honor this most beloved of all irrational numbers? You can let us know at kalw.org. That's also where you can hear all of our stories and subscribe to our podcast. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Sanaa Bhabha, Julie Kane, Martina Castro, Artiems Kunikhoffs, Jen Chien, Audrey Dilling, Casey Miner, Lisa Ratner, Erica Mu, Rena Palta, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Judy Silber. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff.
Boom! That's what I'm talking about!
Ben Trefney is our executive editor.
Come on! Come on!
Cross Currents' theme music is by Oakland's John Santos Quintet. And thanks to City Car Share, which provides an alternative transportation option for our reporters. City Car Share is online at citycarshare.org. Also, thanks to you. We are listener-supported radio.
Come on!
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5. We'll dive into the San Francisco Bay to see what sorts of invasive species are in there.
And if this boat travels to another location, all of these things growing on it have the potential
to colonize in new environments.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents. The music you're hearing is by Eva Mendoza from Oakland. Late last year, Guitar World magazine named her one of 10 female guitarists you should know. She's playing at the Knockout in San Francisco this Wednesday. To hear her and all of the local bands featured on our show, visit our website. It's klw.org. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
Currents weekdays at 5. We've got action.
He's hoisted up by his ankles and hung upside down from the building.
Suspense.
I don't know if you heard that, but we actually just heard a smoke detector battery beep.
Romance.
Jerry, who I've been hanging out with, is my lover.
And style.
The key to his outfit is a pair of homemade AstroTurf armbands.
Kind of like so. That's my trademark, is the AstroTurf.
Not enough? We've also got penguins, politicians.
Don't be economic, girly man.
Medical mysteries.
You would give me a pat on my belly?
Yeah, you know, protect those ovaries.
And of course, music.
Music?
Music.
Music.
Where's the music?
All that in one show. It's Cross Currents, weekdays at 5 on KALW.